Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I'm Scott Trout, CEO of the domestic litigation firm Cordell & Cordell. We help men deal with the life changes triggered by divorce, such as child custody and property division, among many others. But life changes also occur after divorce. These changes can make parts of your existing court order irrelevant or harder to follow. If you feel a modification to your court orders might be necessary, talk to us at Cordell & Cordell. We're a partner men can count on.
Contact CordellCordell.com. 1065 East Hillsdale Boulevard, Suite 310, Foster City, California, 94404.
Hey, what's up, Pelicans fans? Welcome to the Bird Rights Podcast. My name is Preston Ellis, and I am the host and producer for the new home to all things Pelicans on Dash Radio, your new one-stop shop for everything you boogie and brow fanatics need. Now, if you like what you're hearing, follow us on Twitter at The Bird Rights, read our source material at TheBirdRights.com, and most importantly, throw yourself over to iTunes and download every available podcast by searching The Bird Rights NBA Podcast. Subscribe today and find pregame analysis from opposing experts, recaps, rumors, breaking news, and all of the best analysis. What's up, Pels fans? That didn't take long. We are back for a very special Golden State Warriors preview with the OGs. We've got Kevin Berrios with us.
I'm Scott Trout, CEO of the domestic litigation firm Cordell & Cordell. We help men deal with the life changes triggered by divorce, such as child custody and property division, among many others. But life changes also occur after divorce. These changes can make parts of your existing court order irrelevant or harder to follow. If you feel a modification to your court orders might be necessary, talk to us at Cordell & Cordell. We're a partner men can count on.
Contact CordellCordell.com. 1065 East Hillsdale Boulevard, Suite 310, Foster City, California, 94404.
Ali is joining us, but let's move right along to our special guest. You know what, Kevin? You brought him on. Why don't you do the honors? Please shower with praise and introduce our esteemed guest.
Sure. Back in the early 90s, I was really heavily into punk rock music, which I still am. But Mike Park was a guy in a band called Skank and Pickle, and he ran a label called Dill Records, which was really cool. They came through New Orleans a couple times, had to see them play, and I got heavily involved in booking punk rock shows here in New Orleans. And so I booked a few bands on his label, and I even wrote to him a couple of times to try to get some advice about starting a record label on my own, which sort of happened a little bit here and there. But he later on went on to start another label called Agent Man Records. Mike, real quick, before I continue on your preview, would you say your biggest achievement would be, and on that label, the biggest band that people would know would probably be the Alkaline Trio?
Yes, I think that would be the band. Alkaline Trio, or perhaps Less Than Jake, we put out their first record. So that covers two genres. You have the punk and the ska.
Yeah, so those are two punk. I mean, the both labels focused heavily on punk, ska, and reggae, and there was always sort of, a very political and social conscious movement involved in most of the albums that Mike put out, and he even did a lot of, like, you know, compilations that were fundraisers for organizations and tours built around, you know, fighting racism and things like that. He's very active in those kind of communities, very helpful guy to young bands and young labels and clubs and stuff like that. He's always been very helpful. And, we kind of got to know each other through mutual friends early on back in the day. And then there's a local label in New Orleans called Community Records, that's owned by my friend Greg and D-Ray, and Greg actually interned under Mike at Asian Man Records when he was studying music business at Loyola, and they brought him down to play a block party that they were having, and we met up and I interviewed him back in 2013, and that sort of re-sparked our, you know, maybe I guess took it to the next level, our friendship, and we hung out a few times since then. Whenever he comes into town, he's a really big basketball fan, so we go, I take him to a lot of Pelicans games. We even got on the radio broadcast once when we went to a game. They invited us to go watch those guys do the thing, call the game. That was pretty cool. But yeah, Mike, you know, heavily involved in the music business, been there for a while, very active in social justice and that. And he's just a great dude that's really into basketball.
Welcome to the program, Mike.
I'm excited to be here. Like I've always told my friends, if there's one thing I could trade in, I would rather be the 12th man on the worst NBA team than play music. That's how much I love basketball. I would give up the music to be the 12th man. That would be the best job.
All right, you guys
are actually very tall, too. How tall are you? What, 6'5"?
Oh, 6'1".
6'1"? I don't know. You seem to tower over me, and I'm like 6 foot, so...
Maybe it's just a psychological towering over of you. Yeah. You guys can follow him at Mike Park Music and follow his label Asian Man Records at Asian Man Records. Before we get into some of the stuff that Kevin was talking about, Mike, before we get to know a little bit more about you and some of the wonderful things you're involved in, talk a bit about the Golden State Warriors from an atmospheric perspective. When I think of the Warriors, I don't know them very well pre-Curry. I think of like the disastrous Robert Parrish, Kevin McHale trade that, you know, led to all those Boston Celtics titles. I think of Chris Webber's like unremarkable one and done there. Chris Mullin before the NBA Dream Team in 92. And mostly when I think of them, I think of the 2007 8-seeded upset over Dallas with the Don Nelson having been removed from Dallas and leading his guys in a 6-game upset. And then you've got guys like Monte Ellis, Latrell Sprewell, and Jason Richardson. How does it feel now being a fan of one of the greatest teams in the history of the NBA?
To be honest, when they got Kevin Durant, everything was kind of deflated for me because I've always loved them because they've been the worst team and the underdog. And when they won that first title, that was mostly homegrown talent. If you look at Clay, Steph, Draymond, and even like Bogut was a result of the Monte trade. So I was like, he's kind of like homegrown. When they got Durant, it was hard to root for them because they were so good. Obviously, the culture is great. Everyone loves them. The Bay Area is huge. We're looking at, you're covering San Francisco, Oakland, San Jose, North Bay, past the Golden Gate Bridge. Obviously, a lot of people live here, but it's Warriors. Everyone loves the Warriors. And I love them, too. They're still my team, but man, they are so stacked. It's almost unfair.
Wow, that's hard coming from you. I was thinking, you know, even though it kind of feels nice to be the bully, does it feel nice to know that like everybody's talking about how they can't stack up with your team? And we were talking off air a little bit, and it is really fun for like the everyday man. Like I live in Orlando myself. It's really easy to access tickets and to go and see my favorite team whenever I want to, or to go to see the New Orleans Pelicans. Tickets are always readily available whenever I'm in town. And now that you do have this superstar type team, you see all these celebrities, mid-court, you know, you see these stacked seats, you're up in the nosebleed section, you're surrounded by all these, you know, I don't know, upper echelon of people who are paying hundreds and hundreds of dollars to come in and see these games. So you're saying that you prefer being like part of the everyman team, or I guess break down for us how it felt when you started getting Steph Curry and he blew out his ankle, and then Klay Thompson and then Draymond Green, and it all started coming together. Did you realize something special was happening?
I did. Even when they lost in that first round of Mark Jackson's last year, when they lost in 7 in that first round against the Clippers, it's a good team. And I felt they could have won that. Bogut didn't get hurt. I felt like they would have won that series. They were all, this is Draymond's second year. I think it was Klay's. Did Klay come in the same year as Draymond? It's Klay's second or third year. They're all kind of starting to come into their own. And then it was very exciting because there's still this upcoming team and like, okay, it's finally happening. So you got to realize they've made the playoffs once, that We Believe team, like the first time they made the playoffs in how many years? Like such a long time. So the idea of them making the playoffs a couple of years in a row is kind of like, okay, this is kind of cool. And then obviously the next year when they let Mark Jackson go and Steve Kerr came in and they won that first title, was awesome. And then even to the finals, like when Cleveland was, when everyone got injured, that underdog part of me, I still didn't feel bad for them because I hated LeBron so much. So that was great. And then the second title run where they lost to Cleveland in seven, heartbreaking.
Yeah. So we just said how exciting it was for that team with Steph Curry and Draymond in his second year, and then the second year of the championship run, and then how you're kind of like disenchanted with the notion of Kevin Durant joining like already your team that's, you know, going toe to toe with Cleveland every year. So talk about your history with Golden State. You said you kind of didn't like being this team that everybody's kind of, I don't know, shaking their heads at. We routinely see Charles Barkley on TNT saying like, man, I wish these guys wouldn't like get up together and like take on the rest of the league. And Michael Jordan saying that, you know, it's bad for the rest of the league. Talk about your history with the Warriors. What's your favorite Golden State team that you've ever rooted for?
So I'm almost 48. I'll be 48 next month. So I started watching the Warriors when their first title run with Rick Barry. I was very young, but I remember it clearly. And then shortly after, they had an owner named Franklin Muley. He was a horrible owner. He kind of basically sold off his team. So they went from championship team to just terrible. And that's when you had, shortly after, you had the Robert Parrish trade to Boston, where they traded for the rights to Joe Barry Carroll. That was my favorite team because they drafted a second round power forward from Alcorn State named Larry Smith. Larry Smith was a rebound monster. I started a fan club for him in the early 80s, and it made the appreciation of basketball change, where I started to understand the little nuances of the game. And this guy's box score would usually be like all putback shots. So it would be like 5 from 6 on the field, 10 points, 14 rebounds, maybe a block. He didn't have mad hops or anything, but just hard nose player. I don't know if you guys remember Larry Smith.
I don't. 16? Kevin, do you?
I don't.
Okay. So he played 9 years for Golden State. Then he was traded to Houston. And played alongside Olajuwon and Otis Thorpe. Olajuwon got injured and was out for 40 games. And during that span, him and Otis Thorpe went on a tear where Larry Smith was averaging 20 rebounds a game during that stretch. And that was like his first time he got coverage in Sports Illustrated, talking about just his menacing rebounding ability. That was my favorite player. Like, I worshipped him. I would watch the game with different, through different lenses, where I was just watching him, what he would do, how he would block out, how he would position himself on defense. Again, not a big guy, 6'8", didn't have mad hops, just smart, and played so hard. And the guy had terrible footwork, couldn't shoot. His free throw, our fan club, we would wear hard hats because he was such a bad free throw shooter. It was like to protect us from the bricks he was going to throw up, but also his work ethic as this hardworking player. It became kind of big. They were playing tequila, like at the end of the third quarter, they would always play Tequila, the instrumental song by the Champs. And at that time, the Pee Wee Herman movie had come out, and he would do that little dance in the movie. And there was like a group of 10 of us, and we're this little fan club, and we just started doing it when they started playing the music after the third quarter. They kind of like the arena started to take notice, and it would build. And then next thing you know, like the Warriors, people who were working in the Warriors promotion would start come up to us and go, here, if you guys, we'll give you free tickets as long as you guys do this at every game. And we did it for like a full year. They just give us tickets and we would do this dance, and it just kind of grew and grew. It was very strange just being a high school kid, and it was a lot of fun. They were terrible. It was a lot of fun.
No, that kind of reminds... Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was about to transition. I was just recalling my own youth with the New Orleans Saints. We haven't really had a whole lot of successful New Orleans Pelicans teams. We've had the Hornets since 2005 with Chris Paul, but even with him, there wasn't a lot of that I experienced. I was going to recount to the New Orleans Saints when I was a little bit younger. Of course, we always had the Houdat, but in 1991 and 92, I don't know if Kevin will remember this, cha-ching was this really big thing where Seth Green was part of this this hamburger commercial, and he would do cha-ching every time somebody would order a hamburger, and they would play it inside the Superdome, and everybody would start doing cha-ching, and then Ricky Jackson would get a sack, and he would do the big cha-ching, and it got to be so big that they actually called Seth Green in to our playoff game, I think against the Atlanta Falcons, before the game to do his patented cha-ching thing. But it's a small, like, little cult thing just like that really, like, solidifies your love for your hometown team, even though necessarily it's not like, you know, bringing in a Kevin Durant or in our case, bringing in a DeMarcus Cousins. It really, like, solidifies this special nostalgic feeling in your heart of, oh my gosh, I was a part of that. So I totally get exactly what you're talking about. Kevin, do you have anything like that to add? Do you remember the cha-ching?
I do remember the cha-ching. One thing I was going to say is I have, like, a nostalgic thing about the tequila song, which is kind of funny. When I was in elementary school, I remember this so clearly. I can hardly remember anything. My memory is terrible. But I can remember this event so clearly. It was a school function. I was, like, in second grade, and our school band was the worst band you'll ever hear in your life. Like, so we're there, we're gathered. They start playing this crazy ambient noise sound that I would maybe be into at this age. You know, like, wow, this is kind of crazy, you know, like some sort of noise rock band going on. And then all of a sudden there was quiet, and then a tiny little voice just yelled out tequila, and then it all started again, this total chaos. But that was my tequila
is the song that unites all nations, ethnicities, and creeds. Okay, we have gone on for 15 minutes and we haven't talked current everyday basketball, New Orleans Pelicans versus Golden State Warriors. Let's get to the action before we get through any more of our shenanigans. New Orleans home opener is tonight. We're recording this on a Thursday night at the Smoothie King Center for the third year in a row, I believe. March 3rd of this year, 2017, in a loss to the Bulls, was the first time the Warriors had lost back-to-back games in 146 games. So in all likelihood, they're not going to do it again, having lost to the Rockets on Tuesday, 122-121, in a thriller in which, when I was watching, I thought that ball went in. I thought Kevin Durant had released the ball. He usually gets rid of the ball so quickly, I just didn't think there was any chance that it was still on his fingertips, but it was. They ended up losing. However, the Warriors will be down Draymond Green, who is listed as doubtful after an MRI revealed no structural damage, according to Chris Haynes. Mike, how much does the loss of Draymond affect the Warriors? And do the Pelicans have a chance without your, I guess, spiritual leader?
Draymond is my favorite player on the Warriors. Without Draymond Green, the engine doesn't tick the same. I do think they have a chance. The Pelicans have a chance, especially without Draymond Green. I guess it just depends on how is it going with DeMarcus and Anthony? Are they, seems like they're buddies off the court and on the court.
Yeah, I'll take this one before we turn it over to Kevin. AD and Boogie, by all accounts, have worked together wonderfully. Just on Wednesday, they combined for 61 points and I think 28 rebounds. And just last year after the All-Star break, Anthony Davis kept right around his average of 29-11, and DeMarcus Cousins was down in points a little bit, but he was still at 24-12 with Anthony Davis. So these guys play well together. The problem is, with these two guys in the middle, you know, taking every rebound and taking most of the shots, it's hindered the ball movement of all the other players. In this last respective game, Jrue Holiday had 4 points. The bench had 8 points, I think, combined.
Wow.
The bench went a combined 3 of 9. Our starting small forward, Dante Cunningham, scored 7 points. Our third leading scorer was Etuan Moore, if you know who he is, with 11 points. So basically everybody's just doing a lot of ball watching right now. And these guys aren't, you know, Carmelo Anthony. These guys do like to move the ball. I guess it's just a matter of everybody else having the courage to actually take a shot. So the way that we stack up well is you guys are stacked on the wing But without Draymond Green, you've got Zaza Pachulia and, I don't know, Kevin Looney, who are going to, you know, attempt to slow down Anthony Davis and DeMarcus Cousins. So that's what I would think would be our ultimate advantage. But the problem is, like, is it going to be enough? Kevin, why don't you chime in here?
Yeah, I mean, even without Draymond, it's going to be a really steep challenge for the Pelicans. I mean, the good thing is our strength is definitely their weakness with Draymond off the court. I think you're going to see Kevin Durant have to guard Anthony Davis. And if we can get him in foul trouble trying to guard Anthony Davis, that will also help. But, you know, we're definitely going to have to crash the glass against them, go after every offensive rebound, and just pound them and try to get to the line, because our two big guys shoot free throws well. If we can live at the line, then we have a shot. But other than that, you know, those two have great chemistry. I think they work fine together. I just, you know, we just had a very depressing podcast with our other writer, Jamal, about last night's game against Memphis. And, you know, the Drew Holiday thing has just been a nightmare. We don't know what he is, and he doesn't know what he is. But I can tell you what he isn't, and that is he's not a scorer you can count on. And we need another guy to step up and score. And I don't see Holiday doing that, especially if he's tasked with running around guarding Steph Curry or Klay Thompson, and he's going to be on one of those two. So I'm hoping maybe Etuan Moore will step up, be a little bit more aggressive, because, you know, I think he can shoot the ball. And I think, like I said, I think he's a great finisher around the rim. He's got a great floater game. So if we can get him moving towards the basket, coming off of Boogie operating out of the elbow, finding him on cuts, things like that. I think, you know, that's really our only hope. But we definitely need some scoring and some bench production. We need Jordan Crawford to be the Jordan Crawford we had towards the end of last season, where he was, you know, very productive, shooting the three and driving to the hoop and creating plays for other people.
Mike, let me ask you this.
We had Jordan Crawford for a little bit.
Yeah, you sure did. I think that was his last stop before he went overseas. He spent some training camps with the Bulls and the Dallas Mavericks, but the Warriors was the last place he played official basketball. And I think his highest scoring game ever came with the Warriors. I think he scored something around 36 points. Anyway, that was like back in 2014. Let me ask you this, Mike. Pelicans fans have to be hoping that Anthony Davis, DeMarcus Cousins, and Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, and Klay Thompson kind of cancel each other out. Like, you know, maybe the three combined for 70 points for each squad. And then after that, there's going to be some combination of Andre Iguodala, Nick Young, Zaza, Patrick McCaw, Omri Caspi, David West, and Sean Livingston going head to head with our guys, you know, Dante Cunningham, Etuan Moore, Jordan Crawford, this mismatch of players. How well do you expect your reserves to play? How many points should we expect from them? And when your second units come in, like early in the second, maybe led by Klay Thompson, just how dynamic are they? Or is there any kind of drop-off where the Pels can hope this is our time to come back and get in this game?
Yeah, I don't see. I mean, they're so stacked. I feel like from 1 to 10, they're stacked. I feel like their second unit could be a starting five, a playoff starting five. And when Sean Livingston is like your ninth guy, I mean, if you watch the game, the opener against Houston, Kerr played everybody. I think he's just trying to find the rotation. I think the only hope for the Pelicans is really if Kerr continues to find, let's say they find, the Pelicans find a lot of success with Cousins and Davis just being so dominant on the boards, where they just can't, where they're just getting offensive rebounds, easy buckets, and the Warriors fall behind, maybe a double-digit deficit, and he starts playing with that lineup, trying to find some way to stop it. If the Warriors are shooting well, I mean, you just can't stop it.
Is there any potential chance, and maybe I'll throw this over to Kevin as well. We'll start with Mike. Is there any chance that we see like a double big for big lineup where maybe on a second unit we see JaVale McGee matched up against Anthony Davis and Zaza, sort of a kind of like the frustrating guy who's so good at getting into DeMarcus Cousins' head? Is there any potential chance that we'll see those two big guys on the floor at the same time?
It's funny you should say that, because before this started, I thought, I wonder if they'll play JaVale against, maybe he'll play against Davis, and then Zaza will, again, bother DeMarcus. Zaza, I mean, obviously, you look at Zaza and you go, oh, this guy's terrible. But Zaza's a good player. If you look at the finals, he was in the game, and JaVale was not playing because he just didn't understand the concepts that Steve Kerr was trying to put together. And so Zaza is a rock. He can't jump. He knows how to play dirty, and he just plays hard, and he's like an oak tree. But yeah, I wonder if they'll, I guess if they have fine success with a small lineup, because Iguodala is going to be back for this game, maybe they'll just go small. Maybe, like you said, like Kevin was saying, having Durant have to play the four.
Yeah, and David West, I just can't see any world in which David West can match up with Anthony Davis anymore. Maybe you can put his strength and his body against DeMarcus Cousins, but even then, Cousins just has such size, and he's just known for just rolling over these guys into the hoop. Who are you afraid of? I'm going to throw this to Kevin. Who are you afraid of from the Warriors being matched up against Anthony and DeMarcus Cousins the most?
I mean, I think Durant, obviously, he's proven to be a very solid defender, versatile defender, and he's taller than or about the same height as Anthony Davis. And then if Anthony Davis has to guard him on offense, he's going to be wearing him out a little bit there. And he's a good shot blocker. You know, he's got good instincts on that. So I think that's his toughest matchup, especially if it means that Davis has to guard him, which is basically impossible to guard him. He can shoot over anybody. I mean, as you've seen him take incredible shots where he's totally covered and it's like nothing, it just goes in. He's going to be wearing Davis down. I was thinking with your initial question to Mike, I don't think we'll see McGee and Zaza together on the court, but I think you'll see David West and McGee together on the court, where David West can use his body against Cousins, but Cousins will destroy him. I always thought David West was a much overrated defender. I never really bought that whole tough guy, Ray Lewis kind of thing that I've heard people say about him before. But the thing is, he's still got a great mid-range jumper, so that helps them with spacing and stuff like that. Although, I mean, they have incredible spacing anyway because all the other guys can shoot. But it'll at least keep the paint less cramped when they're on the offensive end. One of my biggest X factors in this game is the fact that I'm super happy that Nick Young got his good game in, because I don't think he's going to be that good this week, on Friday, but I think he's going to think he is, and he's going to be taking a lot of shots. So I'm happy about that. I think that could be a thing that hurts them, you know, but that's my take on that.
Mike, we all saw a good bit of Patrick McCaw in the finals last year. How healthy is Omri Caspi right now? And tell us what you've seen from Jordan Bell.
Well, with Caspi, it doesn't seem like Caspi, no matter where he plays, he's always injured. I feel like he was injured on the Kings, and then when he got traded, playing for you guys, didn't he get injured right away last year?
Sure did. He broke his hand his first game.
And then, like, okay, first game here, sprained his ankle. Caspi, I don't know. I know that the writers here feel like, oh, this is a steal for the Warriors. This is a bona fide NBA player that's taking a lot less money to play on a winner. McCaw is a stud. I like McCaw a lot. Homegrown draft pick, great defender. God, he looks like he's like 16 years old. seems like he's got his shot down even more. I mean, he played a lot of minutes as a rookie last year. I think he's going to be a great asset to the team. He's going to get a lot of minutes. He was first off the bench, I believe, on Tuesday also. Jordan Bell, I don't know enough. You know, it's hard to tell after one game. Again, there's just such a backlog of these young, talented, athletic players. I know Bell is supposed to be a good defender. We'll see. I wouldn't worry about it if I was a Pelicans fan. I mean, I'd be actually hoping that these young guys play for the Warriors so the Pelicans can take advantage of their youth.
All right, Mike, before we get you going in on Asian Man Records, I just want to get a prediction from you. Obviously, the Warriors don't lose two games in a row very often, and going into a season 0-2 would certainly feel unfamiliar for these guys. What is your prediction, and do the Pelicans have a chance at home?
You know, I'm going out on a limb. I'm going to say Pelicans upset.
Wow.
Pelicans 118, Warriors 115. And then everyone's going to be going crazy, like, what's wrong with the Warriors? And then the Warriors will go on some crazy streak after that. This is the time for the Pelicans to pull off a win.
I know. Everybody's in total and complete despair in New Orleans last night watching the game. You just had this stream of people. Drew Holiday is going to be the worst contract in the NBA. Why is Alvin Gentry still in New Orleans? Just all these things. We need a point guard, you know, get rid of Jordan Crawford now, bring in Jameer Nelson. So a win against the Warriors would certainly help put us back on the right course. And the first couple of games of the season, you know, you can't help to expect anything. Kevin, what's your take on this?
I don't think we're going to win this game. I mean, I think, you know, the Warriors are going to come out. I forgot what I had predicted in our last podcast when we sort of went glazed over this game. But, you know, I think Warriors 115, Pelicans 99, 100, something like that. I think we'll keep it close for three quarters and wear down and fade. One thing I would like to ask Mike real quick is, if you were a GM, would you hire Alvin Gentry as a coach?
Well, not at this point. I mean, you've had two seasons with him. Obviously, he had the success with the Warriors, but I mean, he hasn't had a lot of talent to use. I was a fan of Williams as a coach too. So I don't know. What do you think? Has he had enough talent to work with to be judged at this point? It's like, well, I think this is the year, his third year, and with two superstars, we'll see how he does.
Well, the argument in favor of Alvin Gentry is that his first year as a coach in 2016 or 15, rather, the Pelicans had a record, an astounding 346 games missed due to injury. It's just been this hilarious, like, beginning. I can't even remember the guys who were starting games for the Pelicans the opening weeks of both last year and the year before. We had, like, Lance Stephenson and Tim Frazier was our second leading scorer for the first 3 weeks of the season. And last year, we still had significant amount of injuries, but Anthony Davis was primarily healthy for the season. He played 75 games, which was his highest ever, but he left about a dozen games early where they would precautionary measures, you know, take him out of the game. But in Alvin Gentry's defense, the first 12 games of the season, no Drew Holiday. And then we get Drew Holiday for about, I don't know, 25, 30 games. And then we trade for DeMarcus Cousins. We get rid of Tyreke Evans, Langston Galloway, Buddy Hield. Nobody is there to space the floor anymore. Instead, you're clogging the middle of the floor. And Alvin Gentry is just constantly being asked to redesign, redevelop with the players that he has available on the floor. And likewise, heading into the summer, he preached, I can't remember how many times, we need shooters, we need shooters, we need shooters. And then we started bringing in these guys like, you know, Darius Miller, Rajon Rondo, Ian Clark, and Tony Allen. And all of a sudden, the dialogue started changing and it started saying, oh, we need guys with IQ. We need guys with veteran leadership. And you can't help but wonder, are Alvin Gentry and general manager Dell Demps on the same side right now? Or are they just literally taking whatever they can get their hands on? So I do feel for Alvin Gentry. I don't think it's totally his fault, but I know that Kevin does. And I'm going to let Kevin explain it for you.
Well, for me, like, I've always, like, considered Alvin Gentry to be basketball's North Turner. Like, he goes to a team as an assistant coach and their offense looks great and people want to hire him, and he comes out and just ends up flat. You know, I hear him, he talks a lot of talk, and he talks about movement, off the ball movement, and, you know, running through screens, shooting threes and all of this stuff. And I don't see movement in his offense for 2.5 years. I was saying the other day, like, I thought when he came here, I'd see Eric Gordon running off the ball through screens, getting open, people finding him. I thought the same thing when we got Buddy Hield, that would happen, but it was just a lot of standing around and looking. You know, I thought we should have, like, you know, sort of dotted dash lines, like a Family Circus comic where, like, you see where the kids had gone through the house kind of thing. If you looked at movement, Instead, we just got a bunch of Google pins. You know, there's nothing happening. And then the way he uses Anthony Davis to me was bad before Cousins came here. He was trying to get him to shoot a lot of threes. He was getting him to post up. He was posting him up far, kind of far from the basket. He's not a back to the basket player. He's a face up big man. He's got a good jump shot, but he doesn't have a 3-point shot. He had him migrating away from the basket, not crashing the offensive glass. And then even last year we got DeMarcus Cousins. It was still not crashing. We weren't focusing on crashing the offensive glass. Then he was running like 5-out sets where everybody, all 5 players are behind the 3-point line. And we have these 2 7-foot monsters out there behind the line, not even one down there to get a rebound or to punish somebody in the post. So while he definitely has injury excuses, when you see how he handles his star player and he has them playing out of his strength, like, sure, Anthony Davis has become a very dynamic player and he probably can shoot the three and he will develop that. He hasn't had a good 3-point percentage yet in his career, and I believe he can because he has a great 20-foot jumper. But, you know, why do you want that to be his focus when he can totally dominate a little bit closer to the basket? And that's my point, is like, you have these great guys that are elite at certain things. And while, yes, you're maybe making them a little bit more well-rounded, you're taking them away from what makes them truly elite, and you're not, and it's trickling down, causing other problems, and you're just like minimizing the impact that these guys can have. They're still going to have great seasons because they're great players, but the team isn't going to be as good as it could be. It's like you win in spite of the coach, and that's frustrating for me. So like, I've never been a fan of his, and I really don't like the way he's handled Anthony Davis and our big men. And also, you know, like you said, like, maybe it was a talent thing. Maybe these guys don't know, but Eric Gordon was standing still in the corner when he was here. And now he's in Houston. He's running through screens. He's running around. He's running off of cuts, baseline cuts, finishing in transition. You know, maybe he's happier there. Sure. But
was he injured at all with the Pelicans? Because he did nothing.
Yeah, I'm going to step in here because Eric Gordon, one, he was chronically injured with the Pelicans. He was always talking about how he didn't want to be here. He preferred to be with the Clippers, and then he preferred to be with the Suns. And then, you know, we matched his offer, which I think was a 4-year, $58 million deal. But everybody talks about Eric Gordon because he was the sixth man of the year. But Eric Gordon does not play that well for the Houston Rockets. He came out hot last year. And then the remainder of the year, he shot something like 34% from 3-point range. And really, Lou Williams kind of did a better job of being Eric Gordon when he was in Houston. But I don't know what his first game was like. I didn't really watch too much of the opening night Golden State-Houston Rockets game.
He was pretty good in that game.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
I mean, my point was, I understand that his numbers look the same, but you watch the way he played running off the screens. My point was, like, not so much that he was a much better player in Houston. It was just that the things that we hear Gentry say that he wants to do, Eric Gordon was doing in Houston, but he wasn't doing them here. And so, like, all these people are saying, like, oh, we don't have the guys that have the IQ to be able to do this and know when to cut and all that. But you, like, he's an example of a guy who went to another team that was the mandate, and he's doing that. And whether his numbers are basically the same or not, he's doing the thing that Alvin Gentry says that he wants him to do, but we never saw him do it in game. So that's what I'm saying, is like, when we hear some of the stuff Gentry says, it's like stuff I agree with. Like, I agree with the idea of a free flow, freelance transition. You know, we have the bigs that can get the rebound, start the break, run it fast. They don't have to make a pass. They can bring it up because they have the ball handling skills to do that. They can charge the rim or they could kick out, all that. They have that ability, and I like that a lot. But when we get in half-court sets, why am I having my 2 7-footers out by the 3-point line? You know, why is nobody moving? It just doesn't make sense. I mean, again, last night out of timeouts were terrible. All last season, out of timeouts were terrible. I've never seen a team be so bad out of timeout that I saw last year, and that's troubling, you know. My problem with Monty Williams was that he would always take too long to set up a play, but when he ran a play, it was great. And like he, and I didn't like that he slowed things down in transition, but why can't we have like a combination of that? And that's what my fantasy is. My fantasy is what Gentry wants in transition, and then what we saw from Finch's offense and Denver in the half court. And I hope that we develop into that, but first game, we saw a little bit of that in the first quarter, and then it just went away, and that can't happen.
All right, now we have thoroughly educated Mike Park on the New Orleans Pelicans on this Golden State Warriors preview. I hope you got enough information, Mike, to know what to expect on Friday. But let's move on to you, buddy. You're involved in social justice and have been making politically charged music for a very long time. I'm getting all this information from Kevin. Chime in whenever you're feeling it, bud. We've had a lot of political, like, charged songs recently, celebrities taking shots at the government and at Trump. I just watched something by Sarah Silverman and Jimmy Kimmel has been outspoken, John Oliver, as well as this big kneeling scandal that's taking the NFL by storm. Give us your views on the current landscape shared between music, sports, and politics. And honestly, I don't know about a lot about you at this point. So just tell us a little bit about your role in all of this and what makes you such a proponent for equality.
Well, just I grew up in an affluent area of Northern California. I was one of five persons of color going through the public school system, just dealing with racism on a daily basis. And as a young kid, you don't really know what's going on. But I just remember clearly, like, wishing I was a white kid. So if you can just imagine those kind of feelings as a young kid, it sucked. And so as I grew older and realized the importance of my culture as a Korean American and being able to accept and love who I am, that's when things changed for me. And it just made it a conscious effort as a young kid, and with my parenting, that it's important to share the ideas of equality. And without being overtly political at the same time, I just want to lead through examples. Like, I just want to be a good person and hope those actions are enough. And so that's how I lead my life in terms of like the current landscape of politics with music and sports, and how people say, oh, well, just stick to sports or stick to your music. You know, you're here to entertain us. I just call bullshit on that. I feel like this is their platform. And it's funny because I've hated LeBron James with a passion for so long, especially when he went to Miami. But I love him now, just because of his political stance and the way he's taken on the president and his voice, his displeasure with police brutality and just being, God, having that much influence on youth. I'm a fan now. And everybody who disagrees with the people kneeling, I mean, I don't understand how it's a negative. They're not doing, it's such a peaceful protest. I could understand if it was anarchists who were destroying property to get their message across, which I don't agree with. But this peaceful protest, I think there's not a better way to share their ideas than get the conversation going by doing what they're doing.
Mike, tell us a little bit more about your music, your company, Asian Man Records. Tell us about how it got started. Tell us a little bit more about some of your bands that I've actually seen Less Than Jake in concert. So I was like, oh, I know who they are. Tell us a little bit about them. What excites you about them, and what kind of stuff you've got coming down the pipeline?
I just, like every young kid who plays music as a teenager, I started in garage bands, and then I had this, when you're young, you're like, oh, I'm going to be a rock star. But then as I got more involved in punk and the philosophy of punk and finding out about these other labels like Discord Records, which is out of DC, SST, which is out of LA, and realizing these are all labels that are run by bands. Discord being run by Ian MacKay from Fugazi and Minor Threat, SST, which is Greg Ginn from Black Flag. And so I thought, well, they're doing it themselves, and that kind of DIY mentality started to form. So that's how I got involved in running
deciding to run the label. It's like, I don't need someone to sign me. I can do it myself, put my future in my own hands. And that's what I did. I've been doing this for so long now. As Asian Man, we're going on 22 years as a company. But before that, I started a band in the late 80s, and we had our own label. So I've been doing this for over 30 years now. And it's fun. I still feel very fresh. We still are working with a lot of new bands who I feel get it, understand what we're trying to do, understand the philosophy of punk we're trying to instill. So it's still fresh and energizing for me, even as I near 50 years old, that I can still be involved in this industry in ethical ways.
Now, you say on your website, by the way, you guys can check out all this information on AsianManRecords.com. I'm looking at the About section right now. You like being a little label. You just mentioned that you like not having to ask people for permission to create music. You like to do it yourself, but you also want to just be about the music. You don't want to like branch out and become one of these mega labels that are, I don't know, all about money or have some agenda that they need to push. Talk about why you like the size and I guess the power, we'll say, of creating your own stuff and why you don't want to push to the next level.
That's just the music business is corrupt. I guess like most businesses, as you get bigger, it's just you deal with a lot of corruption. And it's like, well, who, if you rub my back, I'll rub your back. Like, I don't care. I just want to make my own rules. And so I don't do the music conferences. I don't go to CMJ in New York or South by Southwest and in Austin. Or Midim in Germany. It's just like, I don't care. We do what we do. We run this all out of my parents' garage. I've never taken any classes on how to do this. These are all my own rules. And we've sold well over 1 million units in this little garage. And I take a lot of pride in that.
Now, you guys, if you want to check out their touring schedule, Andrew Jackson Jihad has tours going all the way through the mid of December. Do you want to talk about them at all?
They actually changed their name to AJJ to be more politically correct, but
okay.
Great band. Great band.
Sorry about that.
It's acoustic, like folk punk is what they call it. It's acoustic guitar, stand up, double bass. They're from Phoenix, Arizona. They're big Suns fans. And great band. Also great people. An important factor with Asian Man is you can be a great band, but if you're an asshole, I just don't want to work with you. Like, I'd rather work with good people and lose money than work with mean people. So it's like, it's an important ingredient is you've got to be good people.
Kevin, why don't you get on in here and ask some questions that you've been yearning to perhaps ask Mike for a while now.
Sure. Mike, I think you and I both, we sort of like worshiped at the Church of Fugazi growing up. You know, that was sort of like how we based our, you know, our lifestyle. And like, as I'm getting older, I realize I'm very happy that I did that. But I'm also realized how much of, you know, how much that has affected my my bank account, you know, living that sort of life, you know, where you're definitely not trying to sell out and all of that. And putting ethics and those things before, you know, like I could be a graphic designer working for a big company making a lot of money, but I don't want to make a bunch of advertising to make people feel bad about themselves and to buy things to satisfy their needs or buy a bunch of stuff that they don't want that then is going to be wasted and not decompose in a landfill and create all these other problems. And all of that stems from like getting into Minor Threat and Fugazi at an early age. You feel kind of the same way. You're like, where you're like proud of it, but sometimes you're like, man, you know, I probably could be living a lot more relaxed than I am now.
Well, maybe I should, but the fact is we've done really well as a company, even at this level. So the financial burden is never there for me. So no, I've never felt that way because we've done so well.
It's just you, Kevin. You're the only one living in poverty now.
Yeah, because Mike made it. I haven't. Yeah. But No, the another thing I wanted to ask you too is like, I find it, in, you know, because we're both also getting older and we both got very heavily involved in this when we were much younger and way pre-internet, you know, and it, back then when we first got started, you know, I remember like when I started booking shows, I just looked at, I got bands' records that I liked. They used to have their home address in the record, or sometimes even their home phone number. And I would like handwrite them a letter or call them and be like, hey, if you ever want to come to New Orleans, I got a show booked for you, all of this. And, you know, so we started to build networks like that. They would come in and they would have all their friends' bands' records. They would, you know, trade records, and you learn about all this stuff that way. And it was like this really cool, like, close-knit community. But I've kind of like sort of migrated a little bit out of the music world. I'm still into it and I still do things here and there, but I'm not as, you know, I'm not booking shows and things like that anymore. Although I am about to go on a tour with a band, but I want to know what it's like now with all of this, you know, is it easier to find bands with the ease that they have of just putting everything online and you can just find anything online, or is that oversaturation harder to cut through than when, you know, somebody, when you saw a band that you liked that was sleeping on your living room floor that night because they played, you know, some show you set up at the local bar, you know, they play you their friend's band or leave you a couple of records. Is it easier to find bands now with the internet wave, or was it easier back then?
Easier now, by leaps and bounds. As a consumer, the accessibility of a streaming device like Spotify is unbelievable. That you can find any song in existence almost by just typing it in and then listening to a high quality MP3 is unbelievable. I love it. Also, those DIY shows that people set up that you were setting up when you were younger, it still happens. So, even though I'm old, I still go to these house shows, these underground punk shows, because I'm still involved in this business, and I see some great bands that way.
Yeah, it's got to be a lot less awkward too, having to have somebody perform in front of you when you can just watch them on YouTube now. Kind of cuts that ice for you, that tension. Mike, is there anything else you want to add to plug yourself, to some of our listeners, to check out your label and some up and coming? We mentioned the tours. Is there anything else that you want to drop for the people listening right now?
Nothing about myself. You know, I was just more excited than it. More than anything, I just wanted to talk basketball.
Oh, look at us. We've spent the last 15 minutes leading you away from what we brought you on here to do. Thank you again. Thank you to Mike Park. You could not be more gracious in spending your time with us. And thank you so much to everyone listening. Again, you can follow Mike Park at Mike Park Music and at Asian Man Records. Of course, AsianManRecords.com is the website. You can follow Kevin at Kevin B for Bounce. I am Preston Ellis at Preston Ellis. And I want to tell you a bit about what we've got coming. In the next 3 to 4 days, we will have interviews with two experts from the Lakers and the Blazers, as well as Rory Calais of Locked On Pels. I hope I said that right. Brendan Kleen of Bourbon Street Shots. And hopefully next week, we're going to have rock stars Mike Prada of SB Nation, Justin Verrier of The Ringer, and D. Scott Alexander of Primetime Sports. Fingers crossed. So stick with us, kids. The season is just getting started, and we'll have you covered every step of the way. Kevin, you want to talk a bit about what we've got at thebirdrights.com coming up since Ollie's not here?
Sure. I mean, I don't know. I mean, we'll definitely have some recaps and previews coming up for all those games, surely. I'm currently about to get started on an Etuan Moore season preview, which I have already done the Omer Asik and the Anthony Davis. I was kind of waiting on Etuan Moore to see, you know, if he was going to be the starting two guard. And then my sister's wedding came and kind of postponed that. So I'm going to dive into that in the next couple of days. And, I'm not sure what Ollie has up his sleeve, so we'll have to wait for him to jump on and tell us that.
That sister of yours is so selfish. Well, you guys, stick tuned to us. A bit of news. We are now on Dash Radio, so you guys can find us there. Again, thank you, Mike. We really appreciate you taking the time, and we've got two more matchups this year, so hopefully we'll be able to talk to you again.
That would be great. Love to talk hoops.
All right. Thanks, man. Thank you to you guys, and let's go Pels. Thanks again, Pelicans fans. Again, you are listening to the BirdRights.com's podcast on Dash Radio. Find more on iTunes by searching the Bird Rights : NBA podcast and find our source material at thebirdrights.com.
The Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
Old moon, yeah. That's Hugo tickling the ivories. He just saved by bundling home and auto with Progressive. Gonna finally buy a ring for that gal of yours, Hugo? Send her my condolences. Hi-oh! This next one's for you, too. There's a burglar in my heart. Thank you.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Geico presents yet another voicemail from your roommate.
Hi! So, about the kitchen. Turns out, when there's a grease fire, you're not supposed to throw water on it. Who would have known, right? Anyways, the fire department is here, and it's totally cool. Give me a call back when you get a chance.
The Geico Insurance Agency could help keep your personal property protected, like if danger is your roommate's middle name. Visit geico.com to see how easy it is to switch and save on renter's insurance.